Case number 213367, Judy Fulkerson versus Unum Life Insurance Company of America. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Bacon for the appellant.
Good morning.
Morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, good morning, Mr. Rutter. This case is fairly straightforward. It's about an accidental death benefit on top of a death benefit in an ERISA plan. Mr. Tymuck died tragically about four Julys ago on the east side of Cleveland in a high-speed accident, which the witnesses estimated at over 100 miles per hour and driving recklessly. The ERISA plan paid the basic benefit. At issue is the accidental death benefit. The court below found the word crime ambiguous. We disagree with that, and that's the issue before the court, whether or not to apply the crime exclusion so as not to pay under the plan the accidental death benefit.
Why isn't the policy to define the term crime? Why couldn't it have said something like an offense punishable by the relevant state or local law or something to that effect?
Don't know. I didn't draft it, but the word is unambiguous.
Why couldn't it have said that? I'm not blaming you for it.
There are various types of crimes, and the conjunction that it has to be caused by, contributed to by, or resulting from limits it to more serious crimes by its definition, because the plan administrator has to look at the facts of the individual case. The facts here, unfortunately, are rather horrific because there are two eyewitnesses that saw the deceased traveling at speeds in excess of 100 miles per hour in a 60-mile-per-hour zone. And unfortunately, if you look at the photos of what was left behind, it was a very tragic high-speed accident.
Is it the case then that, you know, think about like marijuana laws, or there are things where some states allow conduct and some states don't. And so is it true that for a certain kind of conduct, if you engage in it and it causes an accident in one state, but the conduct is not illegal versus you cross a state border and you do the exact same thing in the other state, that the policy applies differently?
I don't think so, because remember, this is ERISA, and it's meant to apply uniformly, and you're not bound to the state court definition.
That's just sort of funny about it. I mean, so there's conduct that some states make criminal and some states don't. You can see that turning on what state you're in. In other words, if I'm in Michigan and marijuana is accessible, I mean, just this one example, right. And so I'm doing something with marijuana that causes an accident, but possessing marijuana there is legal. Well, you might argue it's still a crime, even though it wasn't punishable by the local. I guess I'm getting to the point that it's not punishable by the local jurisdiction. It could still be a crime under the policy. If it's punishable in a majority of jurisdictions.
It has to be connected to, caused by the accident. In other words, for example, in the Sixth Circuit case.
I'm just to the crime point. I get the connection or causation part that sort of elevates it. I'm just like, what's a starting point with what's, you're saying there's some offenses, I think, some conduct that is a crime but is not, doesn't cause an accident, so we lack the causation point. But just as a threshold point about what a crime is, that, because that varies so much.
All the courts that have decided this issue under ERISA, not under an IDI or a different policy, have looked to the dictionary definition, and that is an act punishable by the government.
That's the problem I think the district court had. I mean, so that would pick up, you know, a parking violation. You don't think a parking violation counts, do you?
No, and that's exactly what this court considered in the case before it about 10 years ago and decided there was no causation. The lesser traffic offense did not contribute to or lead to the death at issue.
I feel like in this case, you're not using just speeding or even just reckless driving. You're really featuring the 100 miles an hour, right? That really captures it.
Well, that's what...
Right? So just bear with me. I'm trying to figure out how important the facts are versus the debate about what types of crimes are covered. I mean, you know, so if you could imagine a traffic violation where you park the car right in front of the fire hydrant, and because you're in front of the fire hydrant, the fire station, you know, the fire truck can't get water to this building and people die from a fire. Now, it's still a parking violation. Would you say, well, doesn't matter because look what happened?
The facts are always important, Your Honor, and that's why I cited the facts at the start of this. They're always important because there could be some crime that's of such minute value, if you will, that it doesn't lead to the kind of death that was done here. That's the, to me, the differentiator. And even the appellee admits that some crimes are what they are, and they deserve to be recognized. He just draws the distinction that a minor crime, as the court cites, should not be part of the definition. The courts that have considered...
Should reckless driving always be a crime under the policy or not?
Yes, if it leads to the death.
But there's no penalty under the law for reckless driving. I mean, you can't go to jail.
Oh, yes, you can in Ohio. Yes, Your Honor, you can.
For your first offense?
No, not on a first offense.
So,
correct. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Not on the first offense. On a second or third offense, you can go to jail in Ohio.
Why isn't jailable offenses a good definition of crime?
There's lots of definitions, but the courts have always applied the dictionary definition that it's an act punishable by the government. And that dovetails rather nicely into the ERISA objective of uniformity.
We have two cases, I think, that ostensibly apply Kentucky law that said, there are two cases from our court that apply Kentucky law that say that the phrase crime, it's used in different ways, but essentially the phrase crime is ambiguous, right?
I'm not aware of those, Your Honor. I apologize.
The two Kentucky cases, I think you're aware of them, American Family Life and...
Majestic Star, maybe it came out of Kentucky, and if so, I apologize.
Bill, I don't know if that's how you pronounce one of them. That's okay. There's a couple cases in the briefs
The two cases that the district court found applicable are Boyer out of the Eighth Circuit, which was then, in fairness to the district court, on appeal and ultimately reversed. Basically supporting what I'm arguing to the court today. The second case that the district court found applicable was Majestic Star, and I distinguished that one because it was not tied. It was exactly what the court suggests. It was I think, driving without a license and driving without insurance, and the court found that there was no causation because those offenses were not linked to the death. They did not cause or contribute to the death.
Does it make any difference whether this is an ERISA case or whether the person who died had a direct policy?
I think it's more compelling that it's ERISA. It probably doesn't make a functional difference, but it's more compelling under the objective of ERISA. Because technically, we don't even know who wrote the plan. We don't know if the plan was written by the insurance company or by the plan participant. Chances are it was written by the insurance company, and I'm happy to accept that. But ERISA adds that third party to the equation, the insurance company, the employer, and the plan participant. Does that answer your question, Your Honor, I hope?
I think so. If it were policy personally by the deceased, is there a jury question that you would go into? I know under ERISA you wouldn't do that, but...
That's an interesting question. I haven't thought of that. Possibly. I don't think so, because I think all the courts go to the dictionary definition of insurance and say it's a crime punishable by the government. So I would argue that the case would still be dispositive by the court as it was here. I think the answer, again, to be repetitive to your good ERISA question, is it just makes it a more compelling case when you factor in the objectives of ERISA, which are to preserve plan assets for everyone, not just for the insured at issue. So the dynamics change a little bit, but the end result probably should not.
Well, suppose the deceased were charged in a criminal case with reckless driving. Is that a jury question, or is that if he's driving 80, 100 miles an hour, or is that just a matter of law? It'd be a jury question, wouldn't it?
Probably. But remember, in this case, again, because ERISA applies, the administrator has to look at the record before it. And the record before it contained the police report and two compelling eyewitness statements. So the trier of fact, if you will, Your Honor, is different in an ERISA case. And again, that's the compelling part of this argument.
We're doing this de novo, aren't we?
Yes. And that's a good question, Your Honor. To me, it shouldn't change the result. All the cases that have found this have been arbitrary and capricious. But the word is still the word, and it shouldn't change the result, particularly given the compelling nature of ERISA. But you're right, this is de novo review. A couple of other thoughts?
Well, you might want to try rebuttal for those.
All right.
Time just ended.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the other side.
My mask is torn out my hearing aid. Just a second.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Take your time.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bob Rutter, appearing for the appellee Judy Fulkerson here. To follow up on the point that you just made about the standard of care, or the standard of review, it's a very important issue in this case, because all of the cases that Unum is relying on in this appeal were all decided under the arbitrary and capricious standard, every one of them. We are not under that standard. We're under the de novo. So why does it make a difference? Under the de novo standard, the court is bound to apply the ordinary rules of insurance policy interpretation. The number one rule is any ambiguity is resolved in favor of the insured. When there are more than one reasonable interpretation of a term, the insured gets the benefit of the doubt.
That doesn't go to the question of whether there's an ambiguity to begin with. You're sort of jumping ahead, right?
It's ambiguous if it has more than one reasonable definition, which is what we have here. We look in the dictionary, as the magistrate judge did, and you see crime has two definitions. An illegal act for which someone can be punished by the government, especially a gross violation of the law. That's what Unum wants the definition to be. Number two, a grave offense, especially against morality. We say that's the definition that should be applied, and that's the definition that the magistrate judge applied, because under the rule, we get the benefit of the doubt. Now, the reason it makes such a big difference is because...
Is it possible you lose under the second definition?
I'm sorry?
Is it possible you lose even under the second definition?
I don't think
for
traffic...
In other words, 80 to 100 miles an hour weaving in and out of traffic and the predictable
That
happens?
Is reckless behavior, but it is still a traffic violation. It is not a grave offense against morality.
Oh, okay, that's exactly what I'm responding to.
Yeah.
Just listen to me. My first reaction was to hear those words... Your second definition, think about these facts and say, bingo, what am I missing?
Well, to the extent that that becomes a factual issue, I think the magistrate judge resolved that factual issue by saying he did not consider that to be a grave offense against morality. He said there was going to be coverage under the ADD, and in order to do that, you necessarily have to reach the conclusion that we just talked about, that it is not...
Well, tell me, but we're on de novo review. Tell me what I'm missing by jumping to the conclusion that this fact pattern satisfies the second definition of crime. What am I missing?
Well, I think on this review, even though it's a de novo review as to the law, I believe it should still be an arbitrary and capricious review as to the fact determinations by the magistrate. I believe. I'm not exactly an appellate expert, but I think that's the way it works. So you should be looking at the fact determinations made by the magistrate, which were that his speed was 80 to 100 miles an hour, not greatly in excess of 100, and giving deference to those factual determinations.
I'm at 80 to 100 weaving in and out of traffic.
That's definitely reckless. I would never argue that that's not reckless. That is a reckless driving.
Hasn't every
But it
state,
is still a traffic violation.
Hasn't
only.
Every Hasn't every state in the country criminalized that conduct? Isn't that conduct punishable in every state in the country?
I don't know for sure, but I would assume so. Yes, I would assume reckless driving is probably a crime everywhere.
But it's not a serious enough crime. In other words,
it is not a crime against, a grave offense against morality. And I can't say it any better than the court here said it in the Majestic case, where they were construing the term illegal act, and they basically came to the same conclusion that term, illegal act, which I don't think is greatly different than crime, that term was ambiguous and did not rise to the level of wrongdoing for a traffic violation. In that case, I think it was even, I won't say, I thought it was DUI, but I'm not sure.
It just seems influential to me that every legislative body in the country has made this conduct punishable and made it more punishable, reckless driving more punishable than just speeding. So there's an added element here. There's speed and there's risk of harm to person or property, I think. And all of those jurisdictions have made the judgment that this is effectively a morality offense, or whichever dictionary definition you want to use, that this offense is serious enough that it's punishable potentially by imprisonment.
Well, but that's the difference between saying something is a serious offense against morality or it's a lesser offense. I mean, certainly you could make the argument, I suppose, that every crime, jaywalking is against the law. So if you want to look at it that way, you would say, well, that's against the law, so it's a crime against morality. But I don't think that's the common, usage of that term. And that's what people would generally understand that term to mean.
But you just say there's a spectrum, let's accept your point that there's a spectrum, and on one end is the jaywalking, parking in the wrong place, and the last one is intentional murder, right? So we're not going to argue about the last one. Why reckless driving is pretty far along, and that's what seems reasonable to me about this case to say.
Well, I think the other cases that have been decided in this court, I mean, Kovach was a case with a DUI and a going through the stop sign. I don't recall the exact facts of the Majestic Casino, or the Majestic Star Casino case, but they're all the sort of conduct that we're talking about, speeding, reckless, DUI, those sorts of conduct, and this court has held in those cases that does not rise to the level sufficient for the second definition of crime. Now, if you're applying the first definition, and this is why the arbitrary and capricious standard becomes so critical, in that analysis.
On that point, for what it's, I mean, you're referring to the fact that our prior decisions are applying arbitrary and capricious. Is that the point you're making?
The point I'm making is all of the cases that they are relying on,
I got it,
are under that standard. And under that standard, when the provider, here Unum, is given discretion to interpret the policy, the rule of contra preferentum gets turned on its head. The insurance company is then allowed to select any reasonable definition that is most favorable to it. And of course, that's typically what they would do. And then the review is whether or not they have selected a definition that is reasonable
to
them.
There's another limiting factor by the language of the policy, the causation element, right? It's not just any crime, it's one that caused or contributed to a loss. So it has to be conduct that's serious enough that has caused an accidental death or dismemberment. Isn't that sort of a gatekeeper in terms of how serious?
As a policyholder lawyer, that language makes me very nervous because it's not a direct proximate cause language. Contributed to? I mean, if you park outside that building, are you contributing to the offense? I mean, that's a lot of squishy terms there. And Unum has used, for example, they've argued that not having a driver's license is caused to or contributed. They've argued that in the other cases. So I don't take a lot of comfort in those words.
There's a question.
I have a question that this would make the situation in an ordinary claim against the insurance company from ERISA, because if the causation is required, that would become an issue for the jury, would it not, or the judge, or whoever's trying it?
I think under a non-ERISA case, you are doing the normal rules of insurance policy construction. That's probably a fact issue. Yes, I would agree. And here, if you look at it as a fact issue, it would be a fact issue that would be up to the magistrate to decide.
I did look at your standard review section of your brief, and it's all de novo. There's nothing but de novo review mentioned in this case.
It's de novo review of the law, for sure.
Well, I'm telling you, you say nothing else. You don't have any qualifiers or anything about deference to the magistrate.
I guess looking at the opinion, sometimes it's hard to figure out if they're making a factual determination or if it's all legal determination. It's a little bit difficult.
There's really no dispute about the facts here, right? There's no dispute. I know there was a dispute about alcohol, but that's off the table. Yeah. There's no dispute about the facts, the speed, the accident, the weaving.
Well, whether he was going 80 or 100, I guess you could say that's a factual dispute, but it's not really terribly relevant, I don't think. I mean, no matter which speed he's going, it's still reckless. But it does maybe go to the extent of the recklessness, as you were getting to, Judge Sutton. I mean, it could be construed as being
on that sliding scale,
100's worse than 80, right?
I mean, one measure of the extent is that, unfortunately, his car ended up on the side of the road and he passed as a result of the accident. So that's one measure. That's one measure of the seriousness.
Yes, that would be one. Yes. So I think in this case, the decision here that this court came back in Shelby versus Majestic Star Casino, the illegal act case, that was a de novo review. They held illegal act to be an ambiguous term. And this result in this case should not be any different. And we would just ask that the case be remanded.
This is kind of a, I don't mean harsh, but tricky question, but I'm going to do the same thing for the other side, so it's fair. Assume for the sake of argument you lose, how would you wish we wrote the decision? Still losing, there's nothing you can do for your client at that point. How would you wish we wrote the decision so we don't mess up the law in this area? I'm going to ask the same question for the other side. So I'm not, they may both be unfair questions, but I'm just curious since you're both insurance experts.
Well, Judge, I don't know. I don't know if I could give you anything off the top of my head on that. I'm not sure.
Well, one answer is to say it's not all offensives. Reckless driving's pretty far along the spectrum, and it becomes a reckless driving decision. It's not going to mess up lots of other law. It seems to me one way to think about it. From the perspective of people on your side of the case, your side of the V.
Well, I suppose if I had to lose, I would certainly like to have the court say yes, you should be applying the second definition for sure. We agree with you. You should be applying the second definition. It does not apply to every run-of-the-mill criminal violation. Not every traffic violation. Not every criminal offense, so to speak, is going to satisfy that definition. Then make a factual determination that, okay, in this particular case, though, we think this level of conduct does satisfy a grave offense, especially against morality. Okay. That's a little better for me.
All right. No,
maybe
thanks.
Feel a little better, but not much better.
It's not the friendliest question, but we have a job to do. I'm trying to make sure we don't mess things up.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear rebuttal. I'd love to hear your answer to that question from, obviously, you're losing.
Certainly. And I think I would distinguish between ERISA cases and other cases, although the courts really have not. If you look at the Eighth Circuit in the reversal in Boyer.
All right, let's take that option off the table. Now how do you lose?
Crime is not... differently, the different definitions of crime are not important. because there is a qualifier in the policy that connects whatever crime is to the nature of the death. That's what I would say.
Sounds like a theory.
And a crime is defined as anything punishable by the court. But in this case, I think, the reasoning these other decisions address that. It says the defendant is concerned that one mile per hour would then cause him to not get that extra AD&D coverage. That's not a problem because the qualifier mandates that it be reasonable. Mm-hmm. I hope that's an answer. I think it is. Mm-hmm. It's not just any crime. It's a crime of severity that causes a death. So that's all I have, unless you have questions, Your Honor.
No, I think we're good.
Thank you.
Yes,
thanks
to both of you for your helpful briefs and arguments and for answering our questions, which we always appreciate. The case will be submitted.